And now for something completely different.
This is the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Let's do it.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. With you till 3 on this Wednesday, helping you get over the hump and towards the weekend. With plenty to do over the next few hours. Coming up, the difference maker this time of the year in the NBA playoffs. Plus, Mike Bray going after his peers when it comes to name, image, and likeness in college sports. Who in the SEC could be due for the biggest disappointment this year? Which second-year quarterbacks in the NFL are ready to take the biggest leap forward? We'll also talk some golf later on with Jeremy Schilling. I'll rant about a golfer or two. And coming up later on this afternoon, why I think we should expect even more new blood in the college football playoff this year. We'll break it all down over the next couple of hours. A tough night for my NHL team. And a whole lot more over the next few hours. With you till 3, you can join the conversation throughout the afternoon. 843-721-9500 to give us a call. You can always text the show. 843-608-1734. Get to us on Twitter at Morrow Middays. On Facebook at ESPN Charleston. Via email, studio at kirkmanbroadcasting.com. Or online at charlestonsportsradio.com. Head over there and click on our show page where you can leave a comment for the show. You can find the latest versions of the show podcasted right there. Or you can even take the Morrow Midday Show with you wherever you go. Just simply stream us online at charlestonsportsradio.com. With you till 3 on this Wednesday, Trent's on the steel wheels. Trent, what's going on? How are you?
Luke, I'm doing well, sir. You know, great night of basketball. The Heat get a massive win, absolutely dominating performance against Philadelphia 76ers. Overall, the NBA playoffs have just been absolutely phenomenal. Great night of hockey. Playoff sports are the absolute best, Luke. I'm glad to be with you here, sir, on this beautiful Wednesday in the Lowcountry.
Yeah, keep your fingers crossed that if these series go the distance, this Sunday we could have, I think it's 3, maybe 2 game 7s in the NBA. I think maybe 3. And then you'd also could have 2 or 3 in the NHL. We could have a Sunday with 5 or 6 game 7s in playoff series. I don't know if we're going to get there. We'll see, but it's a possibility. Let me start with that. 2 blowouts last night in the NBA playoffs. The Sixers got it handed to them, and so too did Dallas, both falling apart in the second halves. All right, they were competitive games. Well, the Sixers really weren't all that competitive, but Miami really put it away in the second half. And Dallas, they were leading for much of the first half. They were leading into the second quarter. And then Phoenix came out and just buried them in the third quarter. Dallas had 12 turnovers in that third quarter alone. That's a lot for one game, let alone one quarter. They averaged a turnover a minute. And both teams, the higher seeds, at home, did their business and buried their opponent in a huge game 5. By the way, where was James Harden last night? 14 points, certainly hit the under. And the Sixers were a minus 35 with James Harden on the floor. They got outscored by 35 points when Harden was playing last night. That's the worst since Harden has joined the Sixers. You knew that whatever he did the game prior, right, it wasn't going to last. That was a one-hit wonder for James Harden. They expect the bounce back, at least in the wrong direction last night. The regression to the mean, and that's what happened. And the Sixers were dominated. Now, last night's a huge game because history tells us when series are tied at 2, the winner of Game 5 goes on to win the series 82% of the time. Because, of course, you now have a 3-2 lead. You just have to split the final two games, and one of them is going to be at home. It's a very uphill battle for the team that's trailing 3-2. Sure, you could try to win at home in Game 6, force a Game 7, but then you have to go back and try to win in their building. And in these series, the home teams have won every game. But those were two championship-caliber teams last night that took care of business. Right at halftime, they were talking about on the TNT crew for the Suns-Mavericks game. That at the half, they were down, or maybe they're up by, it was a close game at halftime, the Suns and the Mavericks. It's like a three-point game. And the idea was, knowing how important winning Game 5 is in a 2-2 series, and knowing how close it was at half, this second half is the most important to go win the series. If we win this second half, we will most likely win the series. And Phoenix took care of business last night and dominated Dallas. And in the biggest two quarters of the season, Miami went out there and steamrolled Philadelphia. And now both of those two teams are in the driver's seat. But those are two championship-caliber teams. Look, there are levels to this. It's something we talk about a lot. You have to work your way up. Typically, the same in the NFL. It's why I did not expect the Bengals to go all the way to the Super Bowl this past year. Usually, you have to get in there, you lose in the first round, then you come back the next year, you win a playoff game, and then eventually you get to the conference championship. Look at the Memphis Grizzlies. They're kind of skipping steps. They're going to lose against Golden State, right? They'll get to the second round, then they come back. Maybe next time you get to the Western Conference Finals. Maybe the third time, then you're ready to go make a run to the NBA Finals. For the Bucks, it took a while to get there. It's like rocking a vending machine. Eventually, you know, it takes a few rocks to finally knock it over. You got to rock it back and forth a little bit. Takes some time. Or if you're trying to get a car out of like a mud pit, right, you got to kind of rock it back and forth a little bit, and then eventually you're going to break free. But it takes a little time. It takes multiple chances. You have to work your way up. And so as you look at this playoff field, some teams are still trying to work their way up. Other teams are ready to move forward. We talk a lot about experience on the Morrow Midday Show. It's the number one thing you always ask before you jump out of a plane with somebody. Like, how long have you been doing this? Right, before you get on the motorcycle with somebody. How long have you been riding a motorcycle? First thing you ask when somebody sits down for a job interview, tell me about your experience. We always care so much about experience, and it's important when it comes to the NBA playoffs. So, too, is championship DNA. That's another important trait for a wannabe championship team. And so when I look at these playoff series, run through them. Golden State, they have three championships, this same crew. They're going up against Memphis, who is in the second round for the first time with this group of players. The Miami Heat, they're in the finals 2 years ago in the bubble, going up against Philadelphia, who, with this crew, has never gotten past the second round. The Phoenix Suns, they were in the finals last year, going up against Dallas, who is in the second round for the first time with Luka Doncic. And then I'm curious to see how the Bucks-Celtics series plays out, because the Celtics are actually still favored based off of the analytical metrics. But you have Milwaukee, who are the defending champs, going up against Boston, who, with this group, hasn't gotten there yet. They've been close. Maybe this is finally their opportunity to break free. They've been going through the steps and the different levels of the NBA playoffs. Maybe this is finally the opportunity for the Celtics. But you look at those other three series, it's no surprise what's happening. Golden State should beat Memphis. Miami should beat Philadelphia. Right? Phoenix should beat Dallas. Not only are they the higher seeds outside of Golden State, but they just have more experience. They've been there. They've been to a championship before. These other teams, this is the furthest they've ever gone. They've never done this before. And anything you do in life, we know it always becomes easier the more you do it. The first time you do something, you're figuring it out as you go. And you maybe do a poor job. But after doing it a couple of times, for any task in life, maybe even for the job you have, you started a new company, it's a little awkward the first couple of days, you're figuring things out, learning your coworkers and how things work in that company. Maybe you've never done that specific job before. You're learning as you go. But after spending a year there, right, it becomes old hat. Now you don't even think about, you don't even have to think about what you do. It's just become routine. For the first time you do anything new, it's a little foreign. You figure it out as you go. And then after doing it a few times, it becomes second nature. You don't have to think about it. And when you look at these teams last night specifically, Phoenix has been here before. They've won big games before. They knew what to do last night. Season on the line, close game, going into the second half. Winner of this game wins the series 82% of the time. They're at home against a lower-seeded team. They took care of business. Same idea with Miami. Look, they've been here. Jimmy Butler's had more playoff success than Harden or Joel Embiid. Even Doc Rivers hasn't been great in the playoffs. Eric Spoelstra's a better coach. They're at home. They put them away early. They knew Game 5 at home. This is a must-win. We win this game, we essentially win the series. We move on. Philadelphia has never been in this position before. They haven't won a game like that yet. Not with Joel Embiid. Now, last night, Dallas, Luka Doncic has never won a game of that magnitude before. You can see the experience come into play. The Sixers were terrible last night. The Mavericks were good until the second half. Then maybe the moment got too big. Experience is huge. Going through something is important. And when it comes to the NBA playoffs, there's always levels. And you can't skip steps. You have to work your way there. And when you look at all these matchups, it's one team that has won or at least played in some of the biggest games against another team that's just trying to get there. And in at least three of the four series, we'll see what happens tonight, Game 5, Milwaukee-Boston. But the other three series, the team that has the experience and has been there before, yeah, they're the ones handling the moment just fine. Here was Monica McNutt on the Get Up crew this morning. Tim Legler will chime in as well. You also hear Mike Greenberg breaking down that just embarrassing performance from Philadelphia. Season on the line, you get beat by 35 in the biggest game of the year. Here is Monica McNutt.
There's no urgency there, and the idea that you could just flip a switch at this point is bothersome to me, and yes, they have the opportunity to go home and find balance, but this was an opportunity to do something special. You allow a Miami team to continue to develop rhythm and confidence. I thought something interesting that Doc said post-game was that Jimmy Butler has been entirely too comfortable, and he said for three games now. And he is the guy, as his confidence grows, the pace and the confidence of this Miami Heat squad grows, so it doesn't get easier just because you go home.
Legler, I mean, tell everybody how you spent your evening last night. I liked the way you described
Yeah, well, I grabbed dinner, took a little long to get my meal, and then I had to walk my dog, who travels with me. He's in the hotel right now. And by the time I got back to the room with 6 minutes left in the first quarter, the game was over. I mean, the dog wasn't even interested in looking at the game. I knew I had a problem on my hands. I was so disappointed because, you know, obviously, we got two game fives last night, 2-2. Well, I'm sitting down for thinking 5 hours of drama. That's what I want to see right now. Got maybe total of about an hour and a half. And that's all of the first half of the Miami-Dallas Phoenix game. Listen, I don't like the fact that I'm hearing phrases like not engaged, lack of energy. Mm-hmm. I just can't fathom how those words are coming out of people's mouths or participated in this kind of game. I understand if you don't play well, but not to say that. And it was obvious. They're being honest because that's the truth. They weren't engaged. There was no energy. There was no fight. You know, people in Philadelphia, there's a lot being made about as a hangover with Embiid about this MVP thing. I would hope to think that had nothing to do with what we saw last night. I just think they did not have the toughness and the fight necessary for that moment.
That's true. It's hard to defend what you saw from Philadelphia last night or even Dallas in the second half. And this is not some sort of defense, but instead I would say it's also easy to understand why somebody doing something for the first time doesn't look as good doing it as someone who's been there before. I'm not telling you I'm the best radio host around, but having done it before, right, makes it a little bit easier for me than if you plop somebody in this chair for the first time and said, okay, fill the next 3 hours. What we do around here, it's not... Now, we're not digging ditches. But still, to try to fill 3 hours of material for someone to sit down and try to do it for the first time could be a little clunky, as prepared as they may be, as talented as they may be. Could be a little awkward. Takes you a little getting used to. Even for me, when I first started doing 3 hours, when they bumped us up, like, oh, this is a little bit of a difference from two. How do I fill this final hour? Now, that's old hat. When you first start doing something, now you figure it out as you go. A little awkward, a little clunky, and you're going up against somebody, in this case, like Phoenix, like Miami. They've been there before. They've won games like this. They've been in championships in recent years. They know what they're doing, and they're at home last night. Those were big statement victories, essentially winning the series. I find it hard to believe after what I saw yesterday that Philadelphia could win the next two. After watching that second half last night, I find it hard to believe, as good as Luka Doncic is, that he could lead Dallas to two more victories. Those were two veteran teams, Miami, Phoenix, who have won big games, realizing the moment. Whoever wins this game, you win the series 82% of the time. And we're at home, and for Phoenix, right, it's a dogfight at the half. If we just win the second half, we probably win the series. And boy, did they. And credit Miami for really doing it from the jump, but realizing, hey, we're at home. They're beat up. We win this game, we win this series. And boy, did they. They took care of business last night. They gave Philadelphia the business. It'll be hard to bounce back from that even at home in Game 6. When we come back, Mike Bray had some interesting comments about name, image, and likeness, and even kind of calling out his peers, fellow coaches. I think Mike Bray's right on. It's also a bit of a warning. And we'll pair this into Clemson. What should be expected from Clemson this year and moving forward when it comes to football? We'll get to that next. More Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Attention campers. Lunch has been canceled today due to lack of hustle. Deal with it.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
Coming up, Mike Bray with some comments about name, image, and likeness and all the complainers in college sports. Plus, a cautionary tale for Clemson football. Get to that here on the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow on ESPN Radio. Open the show talking about the NBA playoffs last night. We played that clip from Tim Legler, who I thought summed it up well. You get two game fives in 2-2 series. Supposed to be a big night of hoops, and instead you get a couple of blowouts. Now, as I said early on, you look at these series, and, well, there's a mismatch between teams that are used to winning big games like this and teams that still haven't figured it out. So I guess it shouldn't be a surprise that we got those outcomes last night. But in the Miami win last night against Philadelphia, DJ Khaled? How does he say his name?
DJ Khaled. There
yeah,
it is.
My
there
buddy.
It is.
Yep, that's my boy
Your
right
guy.
There. Yep, and another one. DJ Khaled, he was courtside. Now, he thrusted himself all into the action. At one point, he's rubbing the shoulders of the coach, Eric Spoelstra, of the Miami Heat. I have railed against these obnoxious celebrity sports fans, like Kevin Hart at Sixers games. Get him out. Nobody's there to see you. Couldn't care less. Your movies are obnoxious enough. Get off the sideline. You know, at least like Jack will sit there and just with his arms crossed at the Staples Center. Doesn't do anything. Spike Lee, same idea. Get him out. I don't need you talking trash with Reggie Miller. By the way, Spike Lee, he was also at the Brooklyn games this postseason wearing Brooklyn Nets stuff. So what kind of Knicks fan are you anyways? Get out. I'm tired of all these celebrities. But here's Eric Spoelstra after the game talking. He was asked about, because of course, I got to ask him about DJ Khaled. You won a playoff game by 35 points, but what about the obnoxious rapper rubbing your shoulders? Here is Eric Spoelstra's comments, which I thought was a little bit of an odd response to the whole situation. Here's what Spoelstra said after the game last night.
Didn't even know what he, I didn't notice until the end what he was doing, getting the crowd fired up, but I loved it. That's awesome, you know, and I was humbled to be part of that moment. You know, he's such a great fan there, and I've you know, over the years said hello a few times, but that was the best interaction, and that was genuine. It was cool.
Did you know at first when someone was rubbing your shoulders who it was?
Yeah, because I saw him, like, at first, I was like, man, who's on the court? And then I saw him, like, getting the crowd going, and, you know, I generally don't get involved in that, but that was fun.
That was Spoelstra last night. Now I'm all for fun, right? And it's almost like in The Wedding Singer when Billy Idol introduces Adam Sandler when he sings the song on the plane, and he says, we let our first-class customers do whatever they want. Same idea. Like, he's not courtside. He's a celebrity. He's rich. He's rubbing the shoulders of the head coach. He could do whatever you want. Who cares? Curb Your Enthusiasm did an episode years ago where Larry David had those seats. I always find it weird that the NBA will sell seats closer to the scores table to fans than the team itself. You have fans sitting in between the team and the scores table. And so Curb did an episode where Larry stretched out his legs as Shaq was checking into the game, and he trips over Larry's legs and he injures himself. And everybody, of course, gets ticked off at Larry David for injuring Shaquille O'Neal back when he was on the Lakers, you know, 20 years ago. In this case, you got DJ Khaled going over and rubbing the shoulders of Spoelstra. But here's my issue with all this. Here's my rant of the day. At least for now. Rant of the hour. He said humbled, which is just a weird phrase to use to begin with when talking about the experience. How is that humbling? I don't know. But this is my rant, and I've said this to people before. I've had this conversation. There are certain things in this language that I don't understand. On the show, we've talked about how I always believe the expression should be play it by ear. No, what did I say? Play it by ear instead of ear, because it's about time. You're not listening for things. You're giving it time to wait and see. I think that makes more sense. Another one I don't understand is the use of humble. People use this term in the opposite meaning of what the word actually is. If you Google humble, because I had to double check. I'm thinking maybe I'm wrong here. So I Googled it. The definition is to lower someone in dignity or importance. When you go down and you search, it's the first question says, what does it mean to say I'm humbled? And the definition says to feel less important or proud because of something that has been achieved or suffered by someone else. Now, look, Spoelstra, maybe he did feel humbled because you have this rap guy getting all the attention over the coach. But people will say they're humbled after winning awards. Like, I'm so humbled by this award. No, you're not. It's the opposite effect. To be humbled is to be put down. You know what would be a humbling experience at an award show? You show up thinking you get the award, and the committee tells you, yeah, you're so terrible, we didn't even consider you. That would be humbling. You'd be sat down and think, oh, shoot, there's a blow to the ego. That would be humbling. Being called up there to be given an award or an honor or somebody says something nice about you, people's response is always, oh, that's so, I'm humbled to hear that. No, you're not. I know you. I know human nature. Your ego's going out the door. Right? When somebody gives you an award, you're not being humbled. You're being the opposite. You're feeling better about yourself. Your ego's expanding. Your head's growing. So that's my rant for the day. Pet peeve. People always say humbled when they mean the exact opposite. And I see it on Twitter or online or just people in life or like awards. I'm so humbled by this award. No, you're not. How does winning that award lower yourself in dignity or importance? It's doing the opposite. So here's my PSA for the day. You'll hear plenty of PSAs on the station. Here's my PSA. Stop using the term humbled when you mean the complete opposite. And for Eric Spoelstra to say after the game, I'm humbled by DJ Khaled rubbing my shoulders or getting the crowd worked up, I don't even know what that means.
You're exactly right, Luke. I have never thought about that in my entire life. And you are exactly right. You hear it football players all the time.
All the time.
That football players will say on the field, and this is the correct way to use it, they say, oh, yeah, you know, whoever, insert name of linebacker, humbled me on the field.
Yeah.
You know, but people are using it. You're right. At the Oscars, they're like, this is incredibly humbling. It's like, well, no, that's actually
it's
the
opposite. Exactly. That's why they say baseball is a humbling sport. Why? Because you're going to be retired at least 7 to 10 times. You're going to be a good hitter. It's only successful 30% of the time. So the expression, right, baseball is always a humbling sport. It'll humble you because you're going to get out more often than you're not. It's a big pet peeve of mine. I see it all the time, especially online. People always say that. Somebody will say something nice to them, or they'll get it. Oh, I'm so humbled by your – no, you're not. You're having the complete opposite effect. So if you take nothing away from the Morrow Midday Show other than that, you know, please do so. Let's use the word humble properly. And I'm no wordsmith. Right? I screw up the English language plenty of times, but that one I know. Anyways, speaking of words. Oh, by the way, you're a Miami Heat fan, Trent, so obviously you enjoyed last night.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of DJ Khaled on the sideline rubbing the coach's shoulders? Are you into it?
Yeah, you know, I don't mind it, Luke. He's a loyal fan, and that's the most important part of the Heat culture, what Eric Spoelstra is trying to build and has built in Miami for quite some time. So I don't mind it. You know, Drake did a similar thing in Toronto. You remember when he rubbed the shoulders of the head coach for Toronto? I don't really mind it. Probably stay off the court, DJ Khaled, you know, because he was kind of like halfway on the court, basically pumping up the crowd. I'm all good for a celebrity standing up. He's very well known in Miami, so I don't mind it as a true Miami Heat fan. And I'm sure the folks in the stadium wish I was there. Absolutely loved it.
I will say, I do like DJ Khaled. I think he's funny. I like those commercials he's in.
He took over Snapchat. I don't know if you remember this, but like he, for like a 5-year span, everybody just watched him like eat pancakes on Snapchat and just said, get your money up, not your funny up. Oh, it was hilarious.
I remember one video he got caught out in the middle of nowhere like on a jet ski. It was hilarious. So I do think he's funny. I like his commercials. Some of these, like Drake is just obnoxious. It's annoying to me. I don't need any Drake on the court side of the Raptor. And he goes to all these games at other arenas, wearing other jerseys. Get that out of here. But I'll give that to DJ. I don't need him on the court. You know, I don't need him courtside rubbing the shoulders of the coach. But I will say his commercials and other stuff certainly entertains me. By the way, this also, here's a deep reference for you. Cousin Skeeter, that was a great show back in the day. One of the kids was just a puppet, and nobody acknowledged that he was a puppet. Everyone else was humans. I don't get it. But it was a great show. And Shaq was an assistant coach. Here's another Shaq pop culture reference. He was an assistant coach for the basketball team. And at one point, the team got teed up because of his big feet. His foot was over the line. He was technically on the court. This was, of course, a kid's show on Nickelodeon back in the day. This doesn't actually happen in real life. But they teed up the team because they said 6 people on the floor, Shaquille O'Neal, and Cousin Skeeter's team lost because of that. DJ Khaled, he's going to get the Heat a technical for going on the floor. Got to be careful. And while now we're this is, you know, ADD radio, but while we're on the subject, Shaq with his big feet, unfortunately, we lost a legend, and Bob Lanier passed away yesterday at 73 years old. He had size 18 shoes. Shaq wore size 23. It's crazy. Anyways, with all that said, let me get to this. This is what I actually wanted to talk about here in this segment. Mike Bray, speaking of basketball, he had some comments, the head coach of Notre Dame, on name, image, and likeness. And he said, quote, we got to stop complaining. This is the world we're in. We make pretty good money, so everybody should just shut up and adjust. I like these words from Mike. Now, I think a lot of these coaches won't be as honest with you publicly. Mike Bray, those are strong statements. He probably does feel that way. But a lot of coaches, right, will tell you one thing in front of the microphone and say something else behind closed doors because they don't want to hurt their recruiting. But with those strong words, Mike Bray probably does feel like that. But when I hear comments like this, I do think of Clemson, or I think of Dabo Swinney. I think of the comments he's made kind of on the opposite end of this subject. Now, look, I'm a Red Sox fan. I'm wearing my Red Sox jersey today. Thank you to the Atlanta Braves. Red Sox offense has been putrid this year. They finally broke out yesterday in Atlanta. Great to see. I hope they do it again tonight. Sorry, Braves fans. But let's go way back on a Wednesday. Because for the Red Sox, way back when, they originally had a deal in place with Willie Mays. before he signed with anybody. It was 1950. Willie Mays was scouted by a Red Sox scout. He talked to the team Willie Mays was playing for in the Negro League, and they said, you could have him for $4,500. There was a deal in place with this scout and Willie Mays coming over to the Red Sox in 1950. The scout brought that information back to the owner, Tom Yawkey, who is a well-known racist, or at best, someone who was very close-minded back then. And Tom Yawkey said, quote, we already made up our mind. We're not going to take any black players, was the quote he said to the scout. So the Red Sox passed on Willie Mays. A year later, he signs with the Giants, and he goes on to have one of the greatest careers in baseball history. Prior to that, they had a chance to get Jackie Robinson before anybody else. The Red Sox had a tryout for Jackie Robinson at Fenway. And according to reports, the tryout was ended by Red Sox brass after 3 minutes because, again, Tom Yawkey couldn't care less. Jackie Robinson would later call Tom Yawkey the biggest bigot in baseball. This was also a year before Jackie Robinson signed with the Dodgers. Then he would sign with the Dodgers, break the color barrier. This was 1945 when he had a tryout with the Red Sox. Broke the color barrier two years later in 1947. So could you imagine back then a Red Sox lineup with Ted Williams, Willie Mays, and Jackie Robinson? Could have happened. Almost happened. Now, I wasn't born yet, of course, back then. In fact, my parents weren't even born yet when this happened. But even still, it burns me today as a Red Sox fan to think, after hearing all about 1918 and 86, what could have been if they had Ted Williams, Willie Mays, and Jackie Robinson in the lineup for 15 years? That would have been a dynasty. Instead, the Red Sox did not break the color barrier until 1959. Think about that. 12 years after Jackie Robinson. Took them still 12 years. They were the last team in Major League Baseball. And they only broke that color barrier for their team because they were getting sued by the NAACP. And so they had to do something. And so they promoted Pupsy Green from the minor leagues, who was just, it was really just to check a box. He was out of the out of baseball in 4 years. Wasn't a great player. But he got, you know, the lawsuit off the backs of the Red Sox. Meanwhile, this whole story is going somewhere. Meanwhile, 24 teams had integrated by 1951. Jackie came in 1947. 23 other teams followed suit in the next 4 years. So think about that. 1951, again, the Red Sox did not welcome in their first African-American player until 1959, 8 years later. It's a long time. And if you go back and you look at the Red Sox teams of that era, from 1952 until 1966, they never won more than 86 games, despite having Ted Williams, the greatest hitter of all time, on the roster. Never made the playoffs once. For 15 years, they were essentially a 500 or worse team with Ted Williams. And then suddenly, 1967, they make the World Series. And it was called the impossible dream that year for the Red Sox because it seems so far-fetched. But if you go back and you look at that 1967 Red Sox team, second on the team in WAR, meaning the second most valuable player, was George Scott, an African-American who was in his second year with the team. Reggie Smith was also one of the top players on the team that year, African-American who was in his first year with the Red Sox. And their best reliever that year was John Wyatt, African-American who was in his first full year with the Red Sox. When they finally went in that direction in 1967, it led to a World Series appearance and what people called an impossible turnaround. Funny how that works, right? Because they were playing behind the eight ball for all those years. Other teams in the league started to adapt, and the Red Sox resisted because of their owner and his philosophy or thoughts. And it took a long time, it took an extra 15 years to finally catch up to what everybody else was doing. Right? It's a cautionary tale that you need to evolve or you'll dissolve. Right? Your competitors will pass you by. Because while they keep up with the times, and you fail to do so, you're just giving them an advantage. Going back to that Red Sox example, you're only picking from a certain portion of the talent pool while your competitors are able to take anybody they want. And same today with the transfer portal or even name, image, and likeness. If you choose not to go along with that, that's fine. But just know everybody else is. So while you're restricting who you are going to choose from, not taking anybody in the portal, other teams aren't going to restrict themselves. They're going to be choosing from a larger talent pool. Your competitors, like the Red Sox back then, will pass you by. And it wasn't until Boston got on board and realized, like, yeah, you know what? The times are changing. We need to catch up. We're doing ourselves a disservice. They made it to the World Series, the first year that they had a bunch of African Americans playing important roles. So I tell this story as, I guess, a warning for teams like Clemson and others that may resist to the changes of college football, who don't like the transfer portal, don't want to take advantage of it, push back against name, image, and likeness, are not a fan of the changes or the direction of college football. I get it. None of us like change. But you have to keep up, otherwise you're going to fall behind. Now, that's the big picture view for Clemson. What about the smaller picture view? Let's look at this year. What if Clemson fails to win the ACC again this year? What if they miss the playoff once again this year? How would we view Clemson in the big picture of college football? See, I think they're interesting. I think Clemson's one of the most interesting teams in college football this year, maybe the most. I would also put Texas up there, second year Steve Sarkisian, and Texas is just always interesting. Right, USC, first year of Lincoln Riley, Brian Kelly at LSU, Miami with Mario Cristobal. But those teams are mostly interesting because of coaching changes or coaches who are trying to prove themselves. That's what's so fascinating about Clemson. It's that Dabo is probably the most accomplished coach maybe we've ever had, or at least in a long time, that feels like, or at least people believe, he still has something to prove. He still has to prove himself. Ignore the national championships he's already won and what he's built at Clemson and the success that he has had and all the games he has won and the fact that he's dominated that conference. Still, it feels like Dabo, especially after losing his coordinators and the struggles of a year ago, struggles at least for Clemson, still feels like, in the eyes of many around the football world, he still has to prove something this year. Right, originally it was, well, can they do it again? After they had that great season the first time around and they're competing for a national championship or even the first time they won a national championship, you think, okay, that was great, but can they keep this up? Can they do it again? And then they did. And then you thought, okay, but can they do it without a Deshaun Watson or a Trevor Lawrence? Well, last year didn't go so well with DJ. We'll see. And now, especially after losing the coordinators, that's the big question. Yes, Dabo has been great at Clemson, but what's going to happen now without Tony Elliott and Brent Venables with some coaching shakeups for the first time in a long time? These are the questions that, you know, Clemson's going to have to answer this year, making them very intriguing. But I also think Alabama has kind of warped our view in all this. I always compare Alabama to the Patriots, and it's why you get so many coaching changes in those conferences, the AFC East and the SEC, because everybody's trying to keep up with Saban or Bill Belichick. It's an unfair standard to hold somebody to. Alabama in college football is the greatest dynasty we have ever had, what they're currently doing with Nick Saban, and they've been doing it for 15 years. We're not used to seeing that. We've run through them on the show before. Go back to all the dynasties, even Bobby Bowden's Florida State, Pete Carroll's USC. Go back all over the years. Even the best dynasties usually don't last as long as Alabama currently has with Nick Saban. It's unfair to try to compare other schools to the standards of Alabama and what they've accomplished. Now, what are the teams you usually put in that category? Ohio State, Georgia, yeah, sure, Clemson as well. But if you go back and look, Ohio State has already missed the playoffs back-to-back years, and if they don't make it this year, they'll miss the playoffs again in back-to-back years, like Clemson may this season. For Georgia, they've only been to the playoff twice in 8 years. Sure, they just won a national championship, but they haven't been there a ton. And we still hold them in that high regard. So when it comes to Clemson, right, if they don't make it to the playoff this year, does that automatically drop them out of the top tier? I think Clemson also has done no favors by the belief, and I was guilty of this, right, thinking that at one point maybe they did pass Alabama by. That's high praise, and that's a hard standard to be held to. And so when you don't keep up those expectations, it seems like you've fallen a long way, even if you still are in the top tier of college football teams. I think there certainly should be some concern for Clemson if they don't win the ACC or make the playoff again this year. Because you know what they say, if something happens once, it's an outlier. If it happens twice, it's a coincidence. But if it happens three times, now it becomes a pattern. So if this is going to be year number two, then the pressure certainly will turn up for Clemson in 2023. To try and avoid what would be a new pattern. Right, but it wouldn't be the end of Clemson as we know him, not just yet, if they fail to win the ACC or make the playoff this year. And I've already gone on record to tell you that I think the ACC is going to be really interesting this year. I think there's a couple of teams that I could see potentially winning that conference other than Clemson. But to Dabo and everyone else, right, I tell my Red Sox tales to warn you. Like the ghost, as if I'm the ghost of Christmas future, to come along and tell you what could be if you don't change your ways. I like these comments from Mike Bray. I agree with them. I think he's right. You may not like it, but it's the way of the world, and you better adjust or you're going to get passed by. Or go find something else to do if you don't like it so much. Right? But this is the direction college football's moving in, and there's not much you can do about it other than get on board and keep up with your competitors. Because otherwise, you'll be like my Boston Red Sox 70 years ago with all the other teams passing them by like they're tied to a post, refusing to bring on incredible, talented Hall of Fame players just because they didn't like the direction the sport was going in. Yeah, everybody else is signing African-American. We're not going to do that. We don't agree with that. Okay, that's fine. But just know, you're not going to have very much success. The other teams are going to pass you by, and you're going to be choosing from a smaller talent pool. And the same goes for any college football or basketball program that believes, yeah, you know what, we're not going to use the transfer portal. Leave that to everybody else. Okay, that's fine. Stick to your guns, but just know, you're limiting your talent pool while other teams aren't, and they too will pass you by as well. Coming up, which of the SEC teams could be in for the biggest disappointment this year? More Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Attention campers, lunch has been canceled today due to lack of hustle. Deal with it.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
Coming up, which SEC team may be viewed as a disappointment this year? Get to that on the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow on ESPN Radio. So this was interesting. You know, we have the win totals now for college football teams, at least Power 5. They haven't done all the mid-majors yet. So SEC Mike put together a power ranking of all the SEC teams trying to depict their the strength of their schedules based off of their opponent's win total in Vegas. What does Vegas see for all these teams? Then add it up, and it's a pretty good judge here in the start of the year to try to determine who has the tougher schedule. By the way, the NFL schedule is coming out Thursday night. We'll break it down on the show Friday. It's always an exciting day. It's one of those that really shouldn't be exciting. They're just giving you a schedule. You already know all the matchups, but they're just telling you when they're being played. They're slotting them in, and yet it is so thrilling. I love it. I sit there and I peruse it all. Thursday night, we'll come in with plenty of thoughts on Friday. I can't wait. And along those lines, you're seeing the strength of schedule for NFL teams being released this week. Dallas Cowboys have, as of now, the easiest strength of schedule in the NFL this year. Keep that in mind. When you look at the SEC, I find this interesting. Auburn right now has the toughest strength of schedule. This is a huge year, of course, for Brian Harsin. They're looking for every reason to fire him. Now, I already told you where I am on Auburn. I think you take the over, which is, what, 5.5? I think they get to at least 6 wins. I got to 5 last year. Now, sure, they may have the toughest schedule based off of expected wins and losses in the eyes of Vegas. But I believe they only have 4 road games all year. They have 3 cupcakes in the non-conference. And they only have to get to 6 wins. Second on the list is Vanderbilt, second toughest schedule. Those poor guys, they can't catch a break. Florida is 3rd, which is intriguing, right? First-year head coach. First time in the SEC. They had a bad year last year. Looks like they're not going to get any breaks with the schedule. LSU's 4th, so Brian Kelly is going to have to dive right in. Mississippi State 5th, then Texas A&M. South Carolina, at least judging off of this metric, this way to view strength of schedule, the Gamecocks are only 7th in the SEC, which is nice because they've been towards the top the last couple of years. That's followed by Tennessee, Georgia, Alabama, Ole Miss, Kentucky, Arkansas, and Missouri. Theoretically, based off of this study, if you will, this exercise, Missouri has the easiest schedule of an SEC team. Maybe I should rethink my position of believing Missouri's in for a really bad year. Now, the one exception to all this, the disclaimer, is that they do not have the win totals for non-conference teams, at least not all non-conference games, for some of the mid-majors. So you have an Arkansas who will face Cincinnati, BYU, and Liberty, 3 pretty good group of 5 schools that do not have their win totals out just yet. So while Arkansas, according to this list, has the second easiest schedule in the SEC, that is misleading. That's not the case once you factor in their non-conference games. So keep that in mind. But just based off of this, one way to look at the schedules this year, Auburn has the toughest schedule. Florida and LSU are 3rd and 4th. And Missouri, Kentucky, Ole Miss have the easiest schedules. That bodes well for Lane Kiffin, who has to replace an offensive coordinator, great quarterback, playing in the SEC, has one of the easier schedules, at least, to try to do so. Now I was wondering, which school could be in for the biggest disappointment in the SEC? It depends how you want to look at it. If Georgia misses the playoff, how big of a disappointment is that for the Bulldogs and their fans, right? Because they have much higher expectations compared to, say, I don't know, if Florida only wins 5 games, 6 games, how do we compare the levels of disappointment? You know, if Georgia still wins 9 or 10 but don't make the playoff, It's like, well, that's still a pretty good year. Florida will love that season. South Carolina will love that season. Missouri, Tennessee, so many others, every other school in the SEC other than Alabama. But for Georgia, it's viewed as a disappointment, right? So it can be hard to determine, like, who the biggest disappointment is. It's almost like pornography, the definition of which, at least. You can't define it, but you know it when you see it. By the end of the year, you know, like, oh, yeah, that team is the most disappointing. Doesn't matter how many games they won or lost. It's just based off of what you were expecting or how the season looked or how they played in some of those wins or losses. But to try to look at it at the beginning of the season, I'm going to continue on this this train, if you will, that I think Texas A&M, I've been a supporter of Jimbo Fisher, and I've defended him in recent years, and I've expected a lot from Texas A&M. I'm concerned about Texas A&M. Now, they do have the 5th toughest schedule in the SEC, so that doesn't help. But for Texas A&M, I'm very concerned about the loss of the defensive coordinator. They're bringing in a new quarterback. Maybe he'll be a better quarterback. Maybe it's an upgrade. But losing Mike Elko, this team is all about defense. And I would be more concerned about that. And I know Jimbo Fisher's an offensive coach, and right, he's known for his offense and what he was able to do at Florida State. But if you go back and you look, Texas A&M has not been great offensively. In fact, last year they had the second worst passing offense. So they weren't, you know, making their money off of the offense. It was off the defense, which just suffered a huge loss. I could see Texas A&M winning maybe only 7 or 8 games this year when maybe they have aspirations of being a playoff team. In fact, if I were to look at the SEC this year and try to judge maybe like a best-case, worst-case scenario, the team that may have the largest range of possibilities I think could be either LSU or Florida, because they're both two schools that play in a tough conference and are bringing in new coaches. I think Brian Kelly has immediate success at LSU, but it also is, to play the other side of this situation, it's his first year in the SEC. He's believed to not be a great cultural fit. We'll see if that plays a role. Right, it is a tough schedule and tough conference. It always is. Expectations are high. They're coming off 2 bad years. I could see LSU. Would I be surprised if they won 9 games? Not at all. It's kind of my expectation. But would I be surprised if they went just 5-7 this year? Also kind of not that much. I wouldn't be all that surprised. And for Florida, similar. I really don't know what to expect from Florida with Billy Napier. I mean, Florida always has the potential and the talent and the ability and the home field advantage that maybe they could go win 8 or 9 games. Maybe things do click for a Billy Napier in the first year. Based off of how things went last year and first-time head coach and first-time as a head coach in the SEC, if Florida goes 5-7, 6-6 this year, I think that's a realistic possibility. So when I look at these teams and try to judge, like, biggest disappointment, I think it could be Texas A&M. Maybe Ole Miss, if you still believe they're going to be like a top 10 team again this year. I'm cautious. I'm concerned about them. But another part of the conversation that I just kind of threw into the mix as we go is the team with the largest range of possibilities. And in that category, I think I may go LSU and Florida. But I'd also tell you, South Carolina could be a team that maybe fits in both categories. South Carolina may be a team that is seen as a disappointment this year, at least by Gamecock fans, because he had such a high, successful first year at Shane Beamer, winning 7 games, going to a bowl. You bring in Spencer Rattler. The buzz around the program is great. And if you go, say, 6-6, 5-7, that certainly will be viewed as a disappointment, and probably rightfully so. But I could see a range of possibilities for South Carolina, too. You would believe with Spencer Rattler, that gets you at least one more win. The expectation this year for South Carolina probably should be to win 8 games. But they're also set to face 5 ranked teams, set to be an underdog in 6 or 7 games. There could be your 6 or 7 losses. There's a reason why their win total still is only at like 5.5 in Vegas. You have to face Clemson in the non-conference. In fact, you go through a stretch there of Florida, Tennessee, and Clemson in a 3-week stretch late in the year that could be very grueling. So I think there's a pretty wide range of possibilities for South Carolina where I would expect them, the expectation should be to win, say, 8 games. But I could also see them maybe going something like 5-7 as well and missing a bowl. And with Spencer Rattler and the job they did last year, that too would seem like quite a disappointment. We'll wrap up hour one when we come back. It's the Morrow Midday Show here on ESPN Radio.
Now back to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Slipping into the future.
Wrapping up hour one of the Morrow Midday Show at Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. I think I owe a thank you to the Atlanta Braves and all Braves fans out there. Sorry to have to do it at your expense. But the Boston Red Sox, my goodness. I make no qualms about it. I let you know I'm a Red Sox fan through and through. In fact, we have a Red Sox pennant in the studio here, so I have no problem talking about them because I didn't put that pennant up. That's been here since before my time. And, man, their offense has been terrible. Third worst offense in the league. They had scored fewer than four runs in more than half their games all year. They show up in Atlanta, go off for nine last night. A season-high nine runs. That was fantastic. Now I hope they do it again tonight and win this little two-game series. The Red Sox, I think they're 8-1 at Truist Park, the Braves' new stadium. I wish that became their new stadium. I love Fenway, but, hell, let's play there. They dominate in Atlanta for whatever reason. Game two coming up tonight on her sister station. By the way, speaking of baseball, what a brutal night for Citadel baseball. Even I felt bad just broadcasting the game. Up 6-2 in the eighth inning, they end up losing 9-6 and 11. Seven unanswered runs from Winthrop. Tough. Tough, tough loss. Winthrop was on an 11-game losing streak. Now the Citadel has lost seven in a row. That's a tough one. They fall further under 500. Tough night of baseball for Braves fans, for Citadel fans. That was rough. We'll talk some golf when we come back. Hour two next with Jeremy Schilling. The Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.